Okay, we're in business. So first I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk here today. I was actually asked to give a review of radio observations of gamma ray burst afterglows, but given the crowd that we've got here and the nature of this conference, I thought it would be actually more worthwhile to discuss what can we learn about the GRB supernova connection through radio observations. So I have a number of very important conclusions I'd like to nail home today, and in order to do that, I thought I'd just present them right up front. So here is my outline and punchline, if you will. I'm going to show you in the next 30 minutes some pretty strong observational evidence that optical data cannot be used to distinguish between the supernovae associated with gamma ray bursts and those that are not. Actually, radio observations are crucial in this distinction because they trace the fastest ejecta, and therefore these are the observations that can really tell which explosions have relativistic ejecta and which do not. Next, I'll discuss the results from our very large dedicated VLA survey of local type 1bc supernovae. I'll show that we have direct observational constraints on the GRB supernova connection, and this is going from supernovae to GRBs as opposed to GRBs to supernovae. We actually place a very strong limit of 10%, less than 10% of 1bcs hosting off-axis gamma ray bursts, and less than 2% are like supernova 1998BW, in the respect that less than 2% of the local sample produce mildly relativistic ejecta. And finally, I'd just like to emphasize that, again, broadline supernovae show no evidence for relativistic ejecta, and therefore our radio data can actually rule out the standard unification models for these events, which posit that a significant fraction of broadline events harbor off-axis gamma ray bursts. So I'll begin by presenting an optical perspective on the GRB supernova connection. Now, Sri discussed this a bit yesterday, but I believe the conclusions are important enough that it's worthwhile to just go over them one more time. So here we go. In this plot, I've compiled all of the peak optical magnitudes for local type 1c supernovae in yellow and for GRB-associated supernovae in red. I've also compiled, when available, the nickel 56 mass estimates for local supernovae, again in yellow, and GRB supernovae in red. And I want to emphasize that this compilation is up to date and includes all of the published available data for both samples and is available for the community in tabular form in my recent APJ paper down here. So please take a look if you have questions about this compilation. Now, the first thing to take away from this plot is that peak optical magnitude serves as a rough proxy for nickel 56 mass. And of course, this isn't a surprise and comes directly out of the theory, but it is very helpful to know this, especially considering that these nickel 56 mass estimates are very expensive to come by, as I believe Ken will tell us later today. So given that we don't have nickel 56 mass estimates for all of the GRB supernovae to date, it is good to know that we can use the peak optical magnitudes as a rough proxy for what the nickel 56 mass could be. So, focusing now on this bottom plot, there's three important conclusions to take away. The first is that the distributions of peak optical magnitudes for the GRB supernovae and the local supernovae are very similar. Now, this indicates that you can't use peak optical magnitude to distinguish a GRB explosion from a local supernova. And in fact, the similarity between the two distributions may indicate that the nickel 56 production mechanism could be similar between these two samples. And this is actually contrary to the current theories. Second, I want to emphasize that supernova 1998BW is not the brightest event. It's a very common misconception I hear at a lot of conferences. 98BW lies at the high end of the distribution for local 1BC supernovae, but it's by far not the brightest. In addition, if you compare it to the GRB-associated supernovae, not all GRB supernovae are as bright as 98BW. So it's really important to keep in mind that there's a distribution of magnitudes for both of these samples and that they have considerable overlap. And third, I'll just point out again that broadline supernovae, these events represent about 5% of the population, are not overluminous. And again, this may come as no surprise to many of you, but you'd be surprised how often people get confused about which events have bright peak magnitudes and which don't. So really, these large photospheric velocities do not indicate bright optical emission. I think these three points really emphasize that optical data just can't be used to distinguish between relativistic engine-driven explosions and non-relativistic core collapse supernovae. And just to give you an example of this, I thought I'd bring back the case of 2002 AP. Now, this event was spectroscopically identical to 1998 BW at early time, shown here as this nice comparison by Mazzali. The optical luminosity was within a factor of 10 of 98 BW, but if you look in the radio luminosity differs by a factor of 10 to the 4. Okay, this is really where you can distinguish between 2002 AP and 98 BW. This is what really emphasizes that optical doesn't cut it, and radio is really where all the action is going on. So how can you get such a large dispersion of radio luminosities for these events? Well, the idea is, for both GRB supernovae and ordinary type 1c supernovae, we know that they couple the explosion energy to a distribution of ejecta velocities. And it's actually the dynamical interaction of the fastest ejecta with the circumstellar material that produces the radio emission. Therefore, radio emission can be used as a trace of the fastest material and can actually be used to distinguish between engine-driven relativistic GRB and a non-relativistic ordinary core collapse event. Now, as I just reviewed, both GRB supernovae and ordinary core collapse supernovae both produce copious optical emission associated with the slowest material in the explosion. This slow material typically has velocities of about 10,000 kilometers per second, maybe 30,000, but, you know, factor of 3, carries the bulk of the energy, and we observe it as the photosphere, shown here in red. On the other hand, the fastest ejecta can have velocities of about 0.1c up to bulk Lorentz factors of a few on a time scale of a few days. The energy coupled to this fast ejecta can be just 10 to the 45 erg, in the case of some supernovae, can be up to 10 to the 51 erg for cosmological gamma ray bursts. And this is really how you can distinguish between the two kinds of explosions. Actually, it's a very clear way, because you can actually show that the radio luminosity scales almost linearly with the energy coupled to fast ejecta in either of these cases. So the brightest radio events are actually those which have been able to couple the most energy to those fastest ejecta. So how do we go about measuring the energy coupled to fast ejecta? Well, in the case of GRBs, it can actually be pretty tricky, because we know that they're collimated explosions, opening angles of just a few degrees. And so in order to infer the energy, we have to introduce large geometrical correction factors. Those geometrical correction factors are a function of not only the opening angles of the jets, but they're also a function of our viewing angle with respect to the line of sight of the jet. And both of these angles are poorly constrained most of the time. But if you can detect the afterglow at significantly late time, I'm talking months to years here, you can actually perform accurate calorimetry of the explosion in a geometric independent way. And this is, of course, ideal to doing this at early time when it's possible. Now, the idea is the following. So as the ejecta sweep up material and decelerate, they eventually begin to spread sideways quite rapidly. And Jonathan discussed this yesterday. Now, the time scale when they start to spread sideways is roughly comparable to the timescale when they become non-relativistic. So roughly around the time when the swept-up mass is equal to E over C squared, you have a non-relativistic, roughly spherical explosion. And at this point, you can do radio calorimetry. And I'll say that for typical GRBs, this timescale happens around a few months, a year or so. Now, the best case of GRB radio calorimetry is, of course, that of GRB 03-0329 at a redshift of 0.17. Now, we have... there is VLBI direct imaging of the radio jets here, showing that the jets do actually spread quite rapidly sideways with approximately V of C. And this is consistent with what we see in the radio afterglow. Here is the radio light curve for 03-0329 from 1 gigahertz up to about 100 gigahertz, I believe. And you can see that there's a definite flattening in the light curves around 50 days. After 50 days, these ejecta are therefore non-relativistic and effectively spherical. And therefore, this is the right time to perform calorimetry on them. So in doing this, we find that the explosion energy, that's the total energy coupled to the fastest ejecta, is about 10 to the 51 erg for a 03-0329, and it's expanding into a circumstellar medium with an average density of about 1. Now, radio calorimetry has only been possible for the three brightest GRB afterglows so far, shown here in this table. You see that the non-relativistic transitions are actually detected on timescales of a few months to a year, and the energy that is coupled to the fastest ejecta typically is about a few times 10 to the 51 erg. So what about in the case of supernovae? Well, supernovae are a little bit easier. in the sense that we don't have to make geometrical corrections for these events. They're not as strongly collimated as the GRBs. However, it's a little bit more tricky to do calorimetry on supernovae than in the case of GRBs, since the dynamics of these explosions are actually different, since they haven't entered the Sadoff phase yet. I think one of the best examples of radio calorimetry for a local supernova is that of supernova 1998 BW, associated with GRB 980425, at a distance of just 36 megaparsecs. Now, by modeling the radio-like curves shown here, Shri and separately Lee and Chevalier show that the explosion had about 10 to the 49 erg coupled to bulk Lorentz factor 3 material, and that the ejecta seemed to be approximately mildly aspherical. And this might seem like peanuts compared to a 30329, but as I'll discuss next, this is actually quite large when you compare it to typical type 1 BC supernovae. So, motivated by the radio bright emission that we saw in 98 BW, motivated by the emergence of a GRB supernova connection, we began a large survey in 1999 to study the radio emission from local type 1 BC supernovae. When I say local, I mean within about 100 megaparsecs, comparable to the distance of 98 BW. Here are our results to date. Since 1999, we've observed about 150 type 1C supernovae on timescales anywhere from a few days after the explosion out to several years. So here again is radio luminosity and time. All of these light curves are our detected supernovae. Gray triangles are the non-detections. You'll notice that there's a lot of them. And I'll also add that I've supplemented the sample with a couple of other type 1C supernovae from the literature, and these are from the dedicated work of Kurt Weiler and his collaborators. Also, I've added the light curve of 98 BW, and for comparison, the radio light curve of GRB 030329, which had a luminosity typical for GRB radio afterglows. Now, these data here can be used to address two key questions about the GRB supernova connection. The first is, what fraction of local type 1 BC supernovae are harboring an off-axis GRB jet? Now remember, typical GRBs like 030329 become non-relativistic and spherical on a time scale of about 50 days, right? At this time, they're visible to everybody, so this bright radio emission should be seen by all observers. You can clearly see that of all the events we've looked at, none of them have a luminosity comparable to 030329 on this time scale. And therefore, there's strong constraints on the presence of GRB jets in all of these events. But you can also do another experiment. You can ask, what fraction of these supernovae have the ability or have evidence of producing mildly relativistic ejecta like the kind we saw in 1998 BW, shown here in black? So I'll address both of these questions, but I'll begin by discussing the off-axis jets. So here again, radio luminosity and time. Here are all the upper limits from our survey. You'll notice there's quite a few of them. And overplotted are the predicted optical afterglow light curves for a typical GRB jet that's expanding into a wind stratified or a constant density medium and is viewed about 30, 60, and 90 degrees away from the collimation axis, just to give you an idea of what these different light curves look like. You can see that the early limits are better at constraining viewing angles, are better at constraining jets that were just a little bit off axis, whereas the late time limits are better at constraining the jets which were initially directed perpendicular to our line of sight. Now you can see that all these limits lie approximately below the 60 degree angle limit, so there's definitely no evidence for any GRB jets in this sample. And this is particularly true for those broadlined events, which I've emphasized here with green circles and arrows. These are six local hypernovae candidates, and you can see that none of them have any evidence for an off-axis gamma ray burst, despite many claims to the contrary. I want to emphasize this is particularly true for 98 BW. We observed supernova 1998 BW 6 years after the explosion, and we still see no evidence for additional ejecta components coming into our line of sight. And this really confirms the fact that 1998 BW was intrinsically subenergetic. It was not part of a grand unification scheme where it is just viewed off-axis. So this plot I showed you previously was for what I call a typical GRB. And by typical, I meant about 10 to the 51 erg expanding into a circumburst density with about one particle per cubic centimeter. But we know that that's not always the case for GRBs. In fact, they have a range of energies and a range of circumstellar densities. So we can actually use this, We can actually use the constraints to try to place stronger constraints on what the ejecta energy could be for putative off-axis jets. And we get the following plot. Each of these contours corresponds to one of the limits in my earlier plot. And you'll notice that there are quite a few of them. The area to the right of each contour is excluded because it would produce an off-axis gamma ray burst brighter than my observed limits, right? So all of this area is excluded. Overplotted on top of these contours are the available data for GRBs. These are all of the ejecta energies and densities for gamma ray bursts derived from broadband modeling, all of the available data to date. And you can see that most of the GRBs lie in the excluded region for these supernovae. In fact, in order to hide jets in any of these supernovae, you really need to push the circumstellar densities down to about 0.01, or 10 to the minus 7 in terms of mass loss rate, which is significantly lower than the median value for GRBs of about 2 particles per cubic centimeter. I'll especially emphasize the location of 98BW on this plot. Because it was effectively spherical, it's not really a valid question to ask what would happen when it became non-relativistic and spherical, because in this event, you would actually see it all the time. You know, there are no geometrical effects for this case. So statistically speaking, given this distribution of energy and densities, and given our upper limits, we can say that less than 10% of supernovae host off-axis gamma ray bursts. And this is with a pretty good confidence level of about 90%. So now going back to 98BW, of course, the next question is, what fraction of the local supernovae might have some indication of mildly relativistic ejecta comparable to what we saw in 98BW? And here again, I'm showing our radio luminosity versus time, and these are available data. The first thing to take away from this plot is that only 10% of the radio supernovae we observe are actually detected. The other 90% are simply upper limits. But if you take them together, the detections and the upper limits, a typical type 1c supernovae is a factor of 10 to the 4 fainter than GRB 030329 at early time. And it's a factor of 100 fainter than 1998BW on a comparable time. this really indicates just how special 1998BW was. But of course, we can be a little bit more quantitative about this. We can say the following. Given that radio emission traces the fastest ejecta, we can actually be more quantitative about which ejecta energies and which velocities are we ruling out with these limits. Now, it's been shown that synchrotron self-absorption is the dominant absorption process for type 1c supernovae. So by assuming equipartition between magnetic fields and relativistic particles, we can get an estimate for the velocity and the energy of the fastest ejecta. Now, here I'm showing as orange circles, these are the supernovae for which we have detections. And in gray circles and arrows, these are the upper limits from the survey. You can see that the gray arrows rule out fast energetic ejecta, right? The stuff that would be in this area of the plot. And of course, the real punchline to take away here is this is the location of 1998BW with respect to the rest of the sample. This is what makes 98BW special. It's not the optical luminosity. It's not the broad lines. The fact is that we have never seen an event like 1998BW in all the years that we've been looking. And that's really what distinguishes it. Sorry, and I should statistically say that we actually put a limit on the number of supernovae that could be like 98BW in the sense of relativistic ejecta to less than 2%. This is especially true, again, for those broadlined events. I really want to make sure this is well understood. Here I emphasize all of the events which had broad optical absorption lines at early time. 2002 AP, 2003 JD, I think we're going to hear a little bit about 2005 BF later, and I want you to remember that there's no evidence for relativistic ejecta in any of these events. There's really a disconnect between the optical and the radio when it comes to this question. So basically, we haven't found anything like 98BW, we haven't found anything that looks like an off-axis GRB, but it hasn't been all that bad. We've actually learned a lot about type 1c supernovae along the way. And so I do want to leave you on a bit of a up note, and that is to say that supernovae 1bc are actually very useful in teaching us about the circumstellar environment around these explosions. And here is a nice example of that. I'm showing in 2003, there were two very important explosions that went off within a few days of each other. One was GRB 030329, which we've been following extensively in the radio, shown here, and one was supernova 2003L, a type 1c supernova at 90 megaparsecs. Both are still detectable in the radio, and it's been about 3,000 days. Given the different dynamics for the two explosions, however, GRBs, the radius goes like t to the 1/4 to t to the 2/5 when it's non-relativistic. For supernovae, they're still in free expansion, so r goes like t. These 2003L data are actually worth a whole lot more in terms of trying to understand the circumstellar medium. Here are the results from my radio modeling of both events. 2003L requires a wind stratified medium that spans this radius and these densities. GRB-03329, 1,000 days worth of data, only gets you this. But we can learn more just about the profiles and the normalizations. In some cases, we can actually search for evidence of deviations in the mass loss history of the progenitor star. Here's another great example. This is 2003 BG, also from our dedicated survey. Here are my radio light curves again, going up from 4 to 44 gigahertz. And what you see, at 100 days, there's strong evidence for an achromatic deviation from the light curve decay. And radio modeling shows that this deviation can be well fit with a density jump of a factor of about 2, radius of about 10 to the 16, 2 times 10 to the 16 centimeters. And if you assume a Wolf-Rayet wind for this explosion, that puts this mass bump, if you will, This feature was ejected from the progenitor just about 20 years before the explosion. So we're really probing the history of the progenitors in a way that's not really possible with GRBs. And just to summarize, repeating this exercise for all of the supernovae within my sample and all of the GRBs to date, here's a histogram of the circumburst medium for these events. GRBs are shown in red and type 1c supernovae in yellow. You can see that they're more or less constant. There might be some evidence that 1BCs show lower mass loss rates, but obviously we need more data to really tell. But in comparison with the progenitors, we can say that they're more overall consistent with the winds that we see from Wolf-Rayet stars. And I should point you to Roger Chevalier's talk, which will be tomorrow, and he'll discuss more about this. So just to go over the high points, right? I've shown you that optical data really do not allow you to distinguish between GRB explosions and local 1BC supernovae. A radio survey is actually necessary for this, and we've shown that only 10% of the 1BCs are detected, less than 2% are like 98BW, and less than 10% have off-axis GRB jets. And finally, really important to remember that these broad lines do not serve as a proxy for bright optical luminosity, relativistic ejecta, or off-axis gamma ray bursts. And while I do believe these asymmetries are real, they're not the kind of asymmetries that are consistent with GRB jets. I'll stop there.
So congratulations for the huge amount of work entailed by this radio supernova survey. So questions. There is Daniel. We'll give him the first question now.
Could you please tell us if on this graph where you have velocity of the ejecta and energy of the ejecta, do you use this... Do you use the same method and it's equally sensitive to measure those quantities for all the objects?
Yes, all of these objects. I've applied a simple equipartition analysis to all of these objects here. And as I said, all you do is you assume that the emission is dominated by synchrotron self-absorption. You assume equipartition of electrons and magnetic fields. And then you can get an estimate of the velocity and the energy in that ejecta.
Thank you.
The energy of the ejecta, where does it sit on? Electrons or baryons? Is it a pure electron? Because if it is mixed with baryons, same amount.
These are core collapse supernovae. So
this is the total energy of the jet. So if the radius is 10 to the 18 centimeter, and the baryon number, in order not to violate energies, is of the order 10 to the 50, there is no chance of interaction between the electrons and the baryon. So you have to multiply by factor 2,000 this energy in the radio, which is actually liberating the energy of the electrons, to know what is the energy of the jet. So where is the energy of the baryons?
This is the energy just in that fastest ejecta. This is not the total energy of the explosion. This is just the energy in that fastest ejecta which produces the radio emission.
This is not the energy of the electrons which are emitting the radio?
Yes, this is the total energy of the of the particles that are producing the radio emission.
It's not which are total. Which are electron and which yeah. are not which are not relaxing with baryons, because the density at 10 to the 18 centimeter ejecta is very small, so the energy remains on the baryons. The baryons have no way to transfer their energy. What you see is radio, the energy of the electron in the radio, and therefore the energy of the jet should be 2,000 times larger than this calorimetry.
We do take into account, I don't know if I'm sure what you're asking, but we do take into account you know, what we assume for the general ratio of electrons to protons, electrons to baryons, in this formalism.
I don't understand. This energy is the energy of the radiating particles, or is the energy already multiplied, assuming that radio is electrons?
We do include the baryons in this. Yes, we include.
This is converting the energy in the radio to electrons and then multiplying by 2,000 in order to get the energy of the ejecta.
Is that what you do? I think we should talk about. I can show you later what I do. Maybe that would help.
I think there are some more questions, so we should give an opportunity to everybody. There is a question by Lifan.
So first, I'm wondering about the x-axis. Why 98BW has a velocity higher than c?
Sure. So this is just a toy model, right? This is what we do. We just basically look at the radio emission. We ask, what is the brightness temperature, right? We don't want it to violate the inverse Compton catastrophe. And, you know, this is what you get. I'm not including relativistic effects here, but this gives you the general idea that 98BW has evidence for relativistic ejecta, whereas these events don't.
So there are also why, I mean, for this type 1C, what are those supernovae with velocity less than, I mean, velocity only around 0.01C? Which are very, very low.
Sure.
What? How did you get those velocity?
Right. So, well, if you're talking about the limit, there's a little bit of right. These limits are assuming that the emission peaked at the time when I took the observation, right? So these limits aren't entirely bona fide because I don't know when the emission peaked, but it's a reasonable place to put a limit since I have nothing else to work with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because I think in the end it doesn't. I mean, you can't call this eject velocity because we hardly have any supernova type 1C that are at this low velocity.
Sure. So maybe the peak was actually later than I observed, and maybe it would push it around here. But the fact is that the energy is not going to get much higher. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, I want to make a remark here is that. I mean, in radio, you do have, I mean, you see, you observe very late, and you have a problem with uncertainties in circumstellar environment.
Sure.
On the other hand, in optical, we have substantial evidence is that 98BW or 2002 AP and those so-called hypernova, they are probably quite similar to each other. So although some of those have GRB and some of those don't, but
I showed you the 2002 AP light curve and it looks nothing like the GRB light curve, right? It's a factor of 10 to the 6th fainter than GRB on 30329.
The GRB light curve, it just doesn't have a GRB. But on the other hand, its optical spectra and optical light curves are, could be very similar to the ones that are with identified. Supernova progenitors.
I agree that the optical light curves do look similar. That's the point, right? That was the point, is that they do look similar, and therefore we can't really use them to distinguish. I'm not arguing with you. I agree. Spectroscopically and optically, you know, and photometrically, I mean, these events can look similar.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that this hypernova, what we learned from optical, is probably, constrained more tightly of the supernova itself. I mean, I'm saying that, I mean, just how much we can learn from this diagram.
I agree.
It's maybe distorted by the circumstellar environment.
Well, no, so if you're talking about this analysis is pretty robust. I mean, we don't have any sort of, this is not the huge assumptions about the environment that have to go into this, right? I think that 2002 AP is the perfect example of this, right? I mean, we see how similar things are in the optical, and you see how different they can look in the radio, and that's not a false signal. That's really the fact that this is the difference in their fastest ejecta. I'm sorry, can you say it again? Okay. So if it's the limits that you're concerned about, I can tell you that these limits, I can show you how I go about them, but they're just an estimate on the peak luminosity of the radio emission. Now, fine, if you want to push them further, then I'll agree with you, but there is a limit on how far they can be pushed. I don't understand. What is the question? In the slow method. Yes. I'm not assuming anything. That's what I'm saying. I'm not taking into account what they saw in the optical. I'm just saying, based on what I see in the radio, I would come to a conclusion that I'm not seeing much. Not with this. Sure. The question is, what is the velocity of the fastest ejecta? Not what is the velocity of the photosphere in 100 years. It's, you know, what is the energy of the fastest ejecta in the explosion now? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for. I'm looking for that very little bit of ejecta that's traveling very quickly. That's what I'm trying to find.
Yeah, so it says something about distribution.
I agree. Yes, you could draw a plot, energy versus velocity, and say, you know, in the optical it's here, and in the radio it's here.
Sorry, I'm sorry. There is a question here. Somebody who is.
Well, actually, I've got a question and a point. If you could go to the plot where you show all the light curves.
Yeah. The light time?
Yeah, I can give you a little bit of help where you show the light curves with the different supernova. You were there, right there.
Yes.
Yeah. The poster I have out there, which we just finished reducing the newest data on ONEM. Your observations a while back in the optical show that it's probably a type 2, and we're actually charting it as a type 2N, which is,
right?
I think, what you suggested. So the radio emission is probably not from a 1C type phenomenon. It's a thick circumstellar material.
Sure, like in all of these events, it's, you know, we are, the circumstellar material is a very large component, you know, especially in the case I showed you 2003 BG here with the two bumps. This bump is formed by the fact that there is a bump in the density. So you do have to take it into account. I agree that, you know, this isn't a compilation of type 2N light curves, so perhaps I should have left off a 1EM.
Yeah, I was just saying that it's probably not the same beast as these guys.
Sure.
And then your light curve of O3L.
Yes, the right.
Do you have the fits with the four bands?
Oh, sorry. Yep. Yep.
I was just wondering what fitting parameter you're using, because it looks like at the X band there's a strong deviation there with the data and the model.
Sure. So what we assume is that the data are dominated by synchrotron self-absorption and not external processes, and this seems to be generally consistent with the rest of the data. Now, if we did want to assume that there are external processes, it would push the actual intrinsic synchrotron spectrum further up here, which would actually make our energy and density estimates quite larger.
I had a question concerning one of your first graphs. Can we go there to the nickel distribution and the proxy for, or the peak magnitude to the proxy of the.
Yeah.
So as far as I understand, and I would like to hear also from Kanemoto and Paolo Zali, is that for the nickel masses derived, they don't fit independently for the peak magnitudes. So they assume, I mean, in a collaboration, what I've learned was that they take the peak magnitude given from the light curves and include that in the modeling. So I would be a bit hesitant in interpreting your graphs there, because it's, in a way, I would believe, circular. It was in the models assumed that there's a certain peak magnitude, and then therefore a certain amount of nickel was derived. That's my understanding, so I would be very cautious in interpreting this linear relationship, but I would like to hear perhaps from Paolo whether that's the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, we fit the light curves. I actually would have a different kind of comment about those points. Those, I guess your three red dots are the GRB events,
yep.
Right? So, or 3DH98BW, or 3LW. Those happen to be the only ones for which you have good spectroscopy.
Right.
And they tend to have the broadest lines, and they are the brightest spectroscopically observed ones.
Right. The selection effect in many.
Right. Other bumps may be there. There's no spectra, so anything can happen. Why the nearest GRBs with good supernovae should be at the bright, at high velocity, non-relativistically talking again, end of things remains a bit unclear to me. You see no you don't see a difference there. I actually do see it, because if you, I know this is a silly argument, but quite a few of these yellow dots that are hidden under your red dots are very dubious identifications of events that, if you measure the nickel mass, it's bigger than the ejector mass if you try a model. So I'm not sure these are type 1Cs at some point.
What
be type 1C supernovae.
The problem is there's such a few number of events, and I know I've been to a number of conferences, and I get in arguments with people about which dot is this plot and which dot is that one, and, you know, these are what are in the literature, and, you know, in the next few years we're going to have a lot more data, but this is what the data currently show, and I just want to be clear about what the data show and what the ideas are, and these are what the data show. So.
Do you have any information on the polarization of the radio emission of these radio supernovae?
No. So we actually have very good limits on several of the events, especially the bright ones, and I've yet to detect any polarization from these events. So my limits are better than 1%. But it is important to realize that a lot of times you won't expect to see the polarization due to the Faraday dispersion. So it's not necessarily indicative.
Alicia?
Yep.
So you talked about, I mean, I take your point that the radio is better than the optical probably. I was just wondering, how does the radio compare with the X-ray? Do they always correlate when you have the high radio? Do you always have the high X-ray, and especially with supernovae and hypernovae?
Sure. Yes. So I believe that actually Roger will discuss this, or perhaps Klaus, but in fact, what we typically find is that the X-ray emission is brighter than that which you would predict from the synchrotron spectrum. That is to say, if I take the radio light curves I have and extrapolate them out to the X-ray, it's always brighter, which means that the X-ray is not coming from synchrotron, and it's coming from probably some other process.
But does it always correlate? Like if you have high radio, like much more radio in two supernovae, one is brighter than the other, do you always expect it to be brighter in the X-ray? Does it correlate, do you know, at all?
Honestly, I have only a few data points. So far, for the ones I've looked at, I only observe the radio bright ones. So far, I can tell you that yes, I mean...
But it's so far...
I can't tell you
yes,
I guess. I'm not sure.
Okay.
You should let Roger answer.
I think you had a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that there's a direct correlation between radio luminosity and X-ray luminosity. It's a direct relationship. So the radio bright ones are the X-ray bright ones.
No, not always, though. That's
yes.
The point. How do you... There's not... That's the point, is there isn't always a direct correlation, right?
There is. Yes, there is.
But there are like five well-sampled X-ray light curves. I mean,
there are various ways you can produce X-ray emission.
But of 1Cs? 1Cs, I think, are very, very few.
But still, I think that one of the very important things of your diagram is that it shows that not all these gamma ray burst supernova associations are with hypernova, because you show there are a number of supernovae which are not that bright and still are associated with gamma ray bursts. So
exactly.
I think the theoreticians must really scratch their heads about what is happening.
I'll take one more question from Ken.
That question. The interesting thing is the I think the local type 1BC are dominated by neutron star formation case, and I think the GRB case is black hole formation, and the brightness is similar, is rather is just chance, or is there some reason the neutron star case and black hole case is about similar, is a bit interesting or strange or My question is from the radio observation, is there any way to estimate the progenitor mass? Because the progenitor mass is very important to distinguish between the two cases and so on.
Right. I think that in order to estimate the progenitor mass, you really have to look also at the optical data and you have to do a full analysis. Now, I could be wrong about that, but I think that's generally how it's done. I think Roger and Klaus could talk more about that.
Okay, I think we should stop the discussion here. We thank Alicia again. And we now